Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. And as has kind of become the habit recently, we start with water, Craig.
Yes.
Too much of it.
Yeah. They had a big rainstorm down in the Fort Lauderdale area, followed by one in West Palm Beach. And one of the descriptions, which I thought was pretty accurate, was it was a rain bomb. Mm-hmm. And I ended up writing a column for the Florida Phoenix that said these rain bombs are another sign of climate change and how it's changing our world. And our elected leaders don't want to hear that. They only want to build stuff to cope with rising sea levels and not do anything about other symptoms or the causes or anything like that.
It's just nonsensical because both solutions need to be approached. And this was a FloridaPhoenix.com column about the recent storms in South Florida. And I did not realize 26 inches in 24 hours.
Yeah.
And again, you're talking about, you know, rain events that haven't occurred in hundreds of years or more that now occur with regularity. And you rung back up one of our former guests on the podcast, the state's climatologist, to talk about this increasing phenomenon.
Yeah, because he made the point, you know, it's hard to specifically say this one event is tied to climate change. But he said the fingerprints are there. The fingerprints of climate change are there, that these things are becoming more common, becoming heavier, becoming more intense. And this is all stuff that we have to deal with. And the point I tried to make with the column was, even if you love our elected officials and think climate change is a bunch of hooey, this is affecting your pocketbook because it's affecting your insurance rates. So that's why you should care about it no matter what.
A warmer atmosphere is able to hold more water, moisture, which creates larger rainstorms, in the same way that warmer oceans are able to fuel stronger hurricanes. And, you know, that's how this climate change works to power these storm systems. And something that is not discussed enough, I think, with these flood events, these increasing flood events, is the connection development has. And you mentioned that a little bit. The more impervious surface you have, the more roads, the more concrete, the more shopping malls, the more rooftops you have, the more impervious surface, which is that is known as, the fewer wetlands, the fewer forests, the fewer undeveloped natural areas, that runoff has to go somewhere.
Right.
It's going into your living room.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's going to make your car break down and you might wind up with no place to live and no car to drive.
Yeah. It's going to flood your engine. It's going to flood your living room. And all of that concrete, all of that asphalt, all those roofs, all those houses, all those buildings, there's nowhere for that rain to go to be soaked up naturally. So development plays a huge role in this flooding as well. FloridaPhoenix.com. All right, let's head on into the interview today, which also focuses on water and oysters in particular.
Yes.
Our guests are Chucha Barber, who is the executive producer, and Josh McLawhorn, who is the director and editor of a new documentary called Unfiltered: The Truth About Oysters. This focuses globally, but specifically on Apalachicola Bay, where at one point, between 10 and 20% of all U.S. oyster production came out of it, a staggering figure, and now it's zero.
Yeah. They through a combination of circumstances, which we will go into when we enter, I guess, basically it got over-harvested, and the state stepped in and said, we have to stop harvesting for 5 years. Folks in Apalachicola said, on the one hand, they were upset, but on the other hand, they said, why did you wait so long?
Yeah.
Why did you wait so long to do this?
Yeah. Man, worldwide, 90% of the world's ancient oysteries have collapsed in the last 30 years. So, you know, that whether it's bird populations, deforestation, you know, we're seeing, you know, in the last 50 to 30 years, as the Earth's population of humans has exploded, as carbon emissions have exploded, development has exploded, these millennia old systems are being torn asunder in the ecological evolutionary blink of an eye. So the topic today is oysters. Chucha Barber and Josh McLawhorn.
thanks so much for joining us. I really enjoyed the film. I laughed, I cried, I got hungry. You know, so what prompted you guys to do this this work focusing on oysters?
There was a grant awarded to Florida State University by Triumph, the philanthropic arm of BP, mm-hmm. in the amount of $8 million to study oysters in Apalachicola Bay. And both Josh and I thought that that was a very interesting project. And so we went and met first with the vice president of research at FSU at the time, Gary Ostrander, and had a great conversation with him. And we went down to the FSU Marine Lab. And honestly, the more we learned about oysters, the more important the story became.
Interesting, just ironic. Today, as we record, is the 13th anniversary of the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill. So in their attempts to greenwash their economic and environmental ruin, they do throw around a lot of money to philanthropic and arts causes. But incredible irony there. So continue.
I've been someone who has joyfully consumed a lot of oysters. Well, I learned some things I didn't know. What were there things in this, in researching this, that you found out that you didn't know?
Oh my goodness, Josh, I don't know where we begin. Do you?
Yeah, honestly, there are so many things that we learned, and we have a lot of oyster fun facts now that I would have had no idea about. I'll list a couple of them. You know, and a mature adult oyster can filter up to 50 gallons of seawater per day.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
That's a lot of water going through. That's mm-hmm. such a small animal. And of course, there are millions of oysters in a reef. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they're all born male, and then because of, I guess, a population density signal that gets sent out, some of them will change to female.
Don't tell the governor.
Right. Yeah. Funding for oysters is gone.
Oysters are woke.
Yeah. Gosh, there are so many good ones. They're alive when you eat them. You know, when you shuck them, that doesn't kill them. That's cutting the muscles they use to keep their shell together. But they're still alive when you eat a raw oyster.
That's a little disturbing.
Yeah. It's well, and I have to compliment the one shot that you guys did from the oyster's point of view as it's being picked up and consumed. That was quite a shot.
That was definitely Josh's creative idea. He thought of that all by himself. I think that one of the things that's interesting is oysters have a beating heart, and they're the most consumed live animal on the planet.
Wow.
Josh, you're from the Panhandle area. When did you first, and you're a young man, when did you first become aware that there was a massive problem with the oyster reefs, not only globally, broadly, but especially acutely there in Apalachicola Bay?
I've been going to Apalachicola Bay since I was a kid. And to answer your question, I became aware of the problem, honestly, fully when producing this documentary. I was not fully aware of the problem before we started on this project.
Surely you had to know that things had changed, you know, climate change, water pollution. What was it that you were missing, or to what degree did this enlighten you about the true scale of the problem? I mean, surely you didn't think everything was fine.
Well, no, I didn't think everything was fine, but I guess, you know, like a lot of people, I hadn't been focused on that particular issue. You know, I didn't think much about that particular issue, but working on this project has caused me to realize that there are all these pressures on the system. I mean, it's one of those things where I would have arrived at the conclusion that there were challenges to the bay, like, you know, everyone knows about the water wars in this area. Mm-hmm. But it was really learning and listening to these experts as we produced the documentary that informed me and made me care about this issue.
When we started, we actually did know that one of the reasons we started the project was we became aware that there was a problem in Apalachicola Bay. But until we started working on the film, we didn't know that 90% of all the oyster reefs in the world have collapsed. And I'm a native Floridian. I've been getting oysters and eating oysters all of my life. And I don't think I fully appreciated that there's only two kinds of reef systems, a coral reef or an oyster reef. And one of the things that they both do in common is they're estuaries for all these other forms of sea life. So when you take oysters out of the water, you're removing the habitat. And so it can lead to a collapse of everything. And if you, and when you think about it, I mean, not just the fact that it's been an incredible food source for thousands and thousands of years, and not just because it can mitigate red tide and algae blooms, but all the baby fish and the crabs and the shrimp and everything that lives in between those shells. Oysters are the keystone species.
Yeah, the loss of the oyster reefs is tantamount to deforestation on land. I mean, it's to give people an analogy for all of the habitat they create and the ecological benefits, cleaning the water, and that stuff we'll surely get into.
When I first started watching it, I thought there was going to be a really heavy emphasis on the Georgia-Florida water war and how Atlanta was sucking up all the fresh water and messing things up for folks downstream in Apalachicola. And you guys kind of went over that completely, but very, very quickly, and then focused on all the other things that are going on. And I just had to compliment you on that. How are the folks in Apalachicola who used to depend on oysters for a living, how are they doing now that the states had to shut the fishery down for 5 years?
Our understanding is that they are not doing well, that many of them have moved to places where they can still harvest oysters. And the ones who have stayed have not only suffered the loss of their way of life through bay closure and collapsing populations, but there was a fire in East Point
that
destroyed a lot of people's homes. And some people were living in trailers already. So they, you know, one of the gentlemen that we interviewed for the film, he had sort of a camp on some land that he was kind of squatting on. And
Were any of these people subsidized by the government for the loss of the fishery in the way that thousands of farmers in America are subsidized for not farming and for one reason or another?
Not to my knowledge.
Not to my knowledge either.
The other thing that some are shifting to, which is tourism, the people that own the last oyster house in Apalachicola Bay now run Verbo's.
Yeah, what are the threats? We mentioned BP and the oil spill. Craig talked about the water wars with less water coming down into the bay. Summarize for us all the various pressures and threats and problems facing Apalachicola Bay specifically that forced this unprecedented closure of the fishery to allow them to sort of rehabilitate.
In addition to, like you mentioned, the lack of fresh water coming down the river system into the bay, which increases the salinity of the bay and the surrounding area, meaning that, you know, oyster drills and other oyster predators can come in, and that can significantly impact a population. There were instances of overharvest following the BP oil spill, so there was an element of our reaction to the oil spill in addition to the actual damage caused by the physical spill and the attempted cleanup. What John Costigan told us, I believe, was that Florida's legal team, because the water wars were still happening at that time, Florida's legal team recommended keeping the bay open because they thought it would help their case in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ultimately still ruled in favor of Georgia.
The Georgia team argued heavily that Florida had done it to themselves with the overharvesting after the BP oil spill. The other things that I think are important in terms of answering your question is that we discovered there wasn't any one thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's too much fresh water. sometimes it's not enough fresh water. When there's too much salinity in the water, the oysters shut down on their reproduction and try to conserve their energy. I mean, there are so many factors. Like one of the things we became aware of while we were doing the film is that Florida A&M University and Bethune-Cookman received a grant from the National Science Foundation to study the microorganisms that affect oysters, of which there are many. The thing I believe Josh and I tried very, very hard to do, which kind of goes back to your earlier comment about the water wars, is there's no one thing that you can point to and say, but for that, oysters would be fine.
Yeah.
It's not like that. But the really good news is we can make it better.
Yeah. Well, and to maybe start transitioning in that direction, under the conditions that exist there now, which are clearly not ideal, how long would it take for an oyster bed, an oyster reef, to repair itself naturally?
I'm not sure that we have the answer to that. But I will tell you that the researchers at Florida State University have shared with us that they thought that conditions were well thought out for that to happen. And they're concerned why the oysters are not reproducing at the rate that they thought they might. When we interviewed Guy Harvey, one of the things that he said, and I really appreciate that he's in the film, not just because he's known to be a marine visual artist, but he has a PhD in marine biology. He totally gets it. And one of the things that he said, what was the number he said, Josh, was it 40% or 60% that he said should be left alone?
I think he said up to 40%.
Up to 40%. So Guy Harvey believed and expressed in the film that we need to just realize that you've got to leave the oysters alone and let Mother Nature do what Mother Nature does best.
Well, and one element of estimating how long the oysters will, the reefs will come back is, you know, an oyster can grow to market size in 3 years. And that's kind of like what we think of when we look. And so if we leave them alone for a long time, you'll get oysters growing to that size, repopulating more oysters. And, you know, but since one generation of oysters growing that big, you know, can take up to 3 years, it's not exactly an overnight process, even though the shellfish themselves are overall a pretty quick growing organism. Something else too about this that I think is interesting in a way that aquaculture and natural oyster reef restoration can not be at odds is if the farmers are growing oysters that are reproducing, the existence of the oyster farm will benefit the oyster reef because those baby oysters can take root there. So that was an interesting thing.
How many places are there that are doing artificial oyster propagation now?
Oh my goodness. It's really
it's everywhere.
Everywhere. In fact, I shared
everywhere it's legal above a certain line.
I shared with Josh and I had gotten an email over the last couple of days. You know, the slogan for Virginia used to be that Virginia's for lovers, and their new slogan is Virginia's for oyster lovers. And they do tours out to the aquaculture sites in the same way that when Napa Valley started to become the wine place for California, Virginia is really a step ahead. They're doing these great tourism campaigns around, come out on the boat and try this oyster and try that oyster. It's actually pretty cool.
I was fascinated that the folks in doing aquaculture, at least here in Florida, were trying to basically grow seedless watermelons, that they were trying to produce oysters that would not then reproduce because that makes them fatter, I guess. Mm-hmm. Am I saying that right?
It makes them a better product from like a commodity standpoint because, you know, in the summer, normally oysters will attempt to spawn, you know, when the water gets warm and they're, you know, you don't want to eat them when they're doing that. And so having an oyster that you could harvest in the summer is a good thing for farmers because that's when a lot of demand is high, you know, a lot of people don't associate oysters with cold months. They just go to the beach when it's hot and think, I want oysters.
Mm-hmm. The other thing is that aquaculture
has
sort of dispelled that old wives' tale. Maybe it's not such an old wives' tale about, you know, you don't want to eat an oyster in an R month because those months are too hot. And the truth is, that probably was a really good idea to not eat an oyster in an R month, because the oysters are down low in the water column and it gets hot and muddy and whatever. But now with aquaculture, they're up much higher in the water column. And so it really doesn't matter what month. You can eat oysters all year long. That water's constantly moving through and keeping them cool. And it's pretty awesome.
The big thing too with that is just keeping them at a certain temperature. There are regulations now for harvesting that have all but eliminated those bacterial outbreaks.
Speaking specifically about Florida, are these restoration efforts funded primarily through private dollars or public dollars?
Well, there's a combination of sources. I mean, there are some incredibly dedicated not-for-profit organizations. One that we've had the privilege of working with is called the Coastal Conservation Association, and they're doing some amazing work. But I have to tell you, we found one of the most significant recycling initiatives to be in Sarasota. And that was really funded largely because of Ed Childs and the Childs Group. He owns a few restaurants, and he convinced Waste Pro that they should dedicate a garbage truck that's just for the oyster recycling initiative. I mean, other garbage doesn't go in the truck. They go around to the restaurants, they pick up all the shells from the people having eaten oysters, and then they go to what I like to equate to an Indian midden. You know, they're out in the sun, they let the ants eat the stuff out of them, and they stay there. And when we were in Sarasota, I don't know if we planned it or we got lucky. We got lucky with so many things. There were like 300 volunteers putting tons of oyster shells back into Sarasota Bay by the 5-gallon bucketfuls. And it was pretty impressive.
Yeah, he's Lawton Child's son and is also I don't know if he's exactly a trained marine biologist or scientist, but he has some legitimate chops in that field as well. And that Childs Hospitality Group, which has restaurants in Sarasota and Bradenton as well. I happen to be just writing about this recently for the Bradenton Tourism Department. One of those restaurants is on Anna Maria Island. And yeah, those restaurants have a number of sustainability efforts, but that one really caught my eye as well, because the old shells are great.
Reef material.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you can just dump that out. I mean, I'm oversimplifying. You put that out in the ocean and new oysters will grow up around it. Is that how it works?
Well, the thing, it's a substrate that baby oysters want to put their little foot on and stay for the rest of their lives. And the one thing that Josh and I now know is that of all the substrates that work for oyster growth, really what they like most is another oyster. That's like, I'm home, you know, and
I found my people.
I'm with my people. One of the things that Bud is also very much involved in, which we didn't go to because we were doing a film about oysters, is clams. But I'm happy to share with you that Bud Childs and some other friends of ours hosted the post screening party in Sarasota when we debuted the film. And I got to try some of those clams, which I'd never had before. I don't know about you, but I thought they were amazing. So Florida's doing some very cool things with aquaculture.
How big is the aquaculture industry in Florida now?
I don't know how to answer that. Do you, Josh?
I don't really. I know that the leases that are offered by the state are all perpetually filled. And whether that's somebody who's mismanaging it or somebody who's, you know, using it to grow a lot of oysters, I know that essentially last we talked to anyone at the Department of Aquaculture, they were, you know, all the leases were occupied by people attempting to do something with them.
But they are constantly evaluating new places where leases can be placed. For example, when we were doing the film, they were just starting to create some leasing areas in Apalachicola. When we started the film, there weren't leasing areas in Apalachicola right there in the bay, but there was a facility that was creating broodstock. And so they petitioned the state to get some leasing, some lease areas nearby. So I think it's kind of a moving target. One of the factoids that has stuck with me is you can get 30 times the amount of protein from 1 acre of the sea as you can 1 acre of land. So we have to get our food from somewhere, as Dr. Sandra Brooks says in the film. Aquaculture is definitely something that we should be thinking about.
Yeah. It's almost astonishing that our collective, even global efforts are not further along with aquaculture. You know, everything's been so focused on crops, right? Corn, wheat, soybeans, land. And there's this giant ocean out there, rife for the possibilities with all these things. And aquaculture still is globally in its infancy, and the potential is staggering. And, you know, you talked about, you know, we've mentioned the economic benefits to the farmers that oysters have in the state. Josh, you mentioned the water purification that oysters contribute to. Chucha, you just mentioned as a food source. You know, we've got a growing global population that is going to need food increasingly from the ocean. You know, we mentioned the habitat. Storm surge protection is something also that green infrastructure, natural infrastructure, coral reefs, oyster reefs have a tremendous potential and historic track record of helping humanity mitigate the storm surge. Talk a little bit about how oyster reefs protect coastal areas from storms.
Well, as the water washes in, having that first line of defense against the shoreline can be incredibly important depending on the type of shoreline. I mean, there are so many different types of shoreline. And, you know, that's one of the things we discuss in the film, is that not every estuary has the same problem. And so different solutions for different places. But, you know, having a hard series of oyster bars, kind of like barrier islands right out there off the coast, that can diminish that wave impact on the shoreline and diminish erosion and things like that. And something too, I think that's important to note, is that those weather events will kill a lot of the oysters on the reef too. But in a healthy environment, the oyster reproduction would overcome that population hit.
Sure. It's a natural phenomenon. You know, it's not an oil spill or a boat running aground on it. That is like a wildfire. You know, that's a natural part of this whole thing, and it's okay. But when, you know, the oyster reef has been taken out, the wetland has been drained, the coastal dune has been removed, there sits St. Augustine or Sarasota or any other place just with its chin sticking out and nothing, you know, it doesn't have its hands up in front of its face like a boxer just waiting for the right cross to come and break its jaw.
The other thing that's, I think, interesting is that oysters grow in vertical columns, and they're going to go to the top of the water level. So when you think about places like in South Florida that are facing rising water levels, one of the things is one of the scientists we interviewed said, you know, it's not like building a concrete wall and you got to come back and you got to add more concrete. They're going to keep growing so that they maintain the appropriate vertical height to do what they're supposed to do. I mean, it's amazing all the things that they do and the benefits that they offer.
I have to ask you, I was among the many things I learned that I didn't already know, is that you can make beer with oysters. Can you talk a little bit about that?
We didn't know that either.
Yeah, that was serendipitous.
That was a pretty funny day. I like to share with people that Josh and I have had the privilege of working together on a number of projects, different subject matter. And we have done some very emotional interviews, you know, with all kinds of people, but none have been more emotional than the one that we did with Tommy Ward, who is a multi-generation wild oyster harvester. I mean, his lip was quivering and he had trouble talking and getting through some of the things we asked him. And when we were done, Josh and I decided we could use a drink, and Oyster City Beer was right across the street. And we went over there, and that there were two guys inside that identified themselves as the brewmasters. And we started talking to them about, so it's really true that, you know, you can make beer from oyster. We've been doing it for 100 years. And so Josh and I talked to them and they agreed to do a brew for us. And because there are better materials now and, you know, different kinds of things. And didn't we start at 4 a.m. or some obscene time like that, Josh?
Started really early.
Early in the morning. Yeah. They did a special brew for us. And then we found out that the hardest thing about making a new beer is naming it. Because there are so many.
A lot of craft breweries naming a lot of beers all the time.
Yeah.
We wanted to call it Cluster Shuck, but that And so they ended up, because it's, was it a Goiza? Is that what it was, Josh, that we made? It was sour.
That sounds
good. Yeah, Goza.
Yeah. And so we ended up calling it Pucker Shucker. And, I still like Cluster Shuck better, but anyway.
How do the oysters work into the brewing process?
Josh, go for it.
You know, maybe my palate's not good enough to taste the difference, but I can't quite tell the difference between beers with oysters and beers without. But I think the idea is that back in the day, in an attempt to filter the beer, putting oyster shells in there might have done something to help hold on to more of the particulate matter or something and kind of clarify the beer. And then I think as far as flavor, the oyster liquor, which is like their bodily fluid, and, you know, the oyster as it boils with the initial boil, I think it's supposed to impart some brininess of flavor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm.
So there was the shells, they said, were added to the clarity, and the oyster liquor adds to the brininess. And then they used the animal too. They put them in these like mesh sacks and dropped them in the vat. Good news is they didn't scream like a lobster when you boiled them, but it's still interesting.
Yeah, that would be kind of a downer. How many oysters did you eat while you were making this film?
We should have kept the tally. That would have been. I shucked my first oyster on a boat with one of the people we went out on a shoot with.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
He taught me how to do it, and I learned, and now I've got a technique down that works, so I can eat oysters at home now.
Yeah. Plus, you got another career to fall back on if this filmmaking thing doesn't work out.
Hey, you know, it's high-end restaurants have to have good shuckers.
Following this project, are you generally more optimistic or pessimistic about the future of the oyster reefs?
Optimistic.
That's good.
I believe that if Florida has the political will, we could become a global leader. The other thing that I believe the film conveys very, very well is how the Army Corps of Engineers, mandated by Congress to be to address certain matters, including the navigation of rivers and hydropower and flood control, and to a lesser extent, drinking water, but nothing about their existence has anything to do with environment or critters. And so Josh and I have had meetings with some Florida legislators and shared the film with them privately in the hopes that they will write some legislation first for Florida, which might then motivate people on the federal level to change the mission statement, if you will, of the Army Corps of Engineers. And right now, it's a huge issue because nobody wants to deal with a problem that's not in their neighborhood. And yet everyone's having the same problem. The people in California, they're not getting any water from the Colorado River into the Baja. And the people in Mississippi are having issues with the Mississippi River. And so the reality is that if people could start, and when I say people, I'm really talking about if we could muster the political will to look beyond our immediate jurisdiction, we can make a collective change that would be really pretty powerful.
Josh, optimistic or pessimistic?
I suppose I'm optimistic, but realistic. I think that in order for us to really fix a lot of our big ecological problems, it's going to take everything. And that's a big ask. I think it's going to take a cultural shift, in communities and individual people. I think it's going to take political will in the form of funding for, frankly, conservation. I mean, funding for buying up land for it to not be developed, not to develop it in the least worst way, but to buy it to not develop it. And I think that there we have a whole lot of economic incentives that are counter to that. And I think that
no doubt
it's going to take a lot in order for us to not continue to see decline. But I think it's possible. I think it really is. And I just hope that it happens before. I hope that some of these things we need start to happen before it's too late to get the oysters back.
It reminds me, Craig, of our episode last week about solar power. All the solutions are there. Every bit of technology is there. The money is there. All we lack is the will to do it, and really the want to do it, and the desire to put clean energy and habitat and natural solutions and ecology and the health of the planet over personal and corporate interests.
Yeah. Of course, the big difference is oysters taste better than solar panels. So there's an incentive.
How people can find the documentary and watch it for themselves?
Well, right now they can only see the film if they attend one of the film festivals that we are hoping to be at. And we are working with about 15 more film festivals. But there's a great website, oyster.film, and the trailer is there. And I certainly would hope that people would at least have an interest to watch the trailer. Josh and I have a business plan for the film, which includes doing film festivals for about 12 to 18 months. And then hopefully we'll be able to negotiate a relationship with a streaming service.
I was wondering if you were going to do that or perhaps go through public television in Florida, because I think this is would be a great topic for them to show.
That's a great
idea. I agree. We have talked about both options.
Okay. I'll put a link to oyster.film down in the show notes and everyone can check it out for themselves and stay abreast with that schedule of film festivals. Josh McClawhorn and Chucha Barber, thank you so much for joining us today. And the documentary looks fantastic. We're looking forward to a wide release around Florida and the
Here's
world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So people can learn more about how to save the oyster, because the oyster can save us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. Thank you. We really appreciate it.
The humble oyster, Craig, but when you think about as a food source, as an economic driver, as habitat, as water filtration, as coastal storm surge protection, boy, oh boy, you said it well. We need to protect the oyster because the oyster can protect us.
Well, exactly. I mean, and this is a very small part of the documentary, but it mentioned that I think it was the Manatee River down in Manatee County used to be known as the Oyster River because there were so many oysters there. It was wall to wall oysters. And then they came through and dredged it for boats to come through, and other factors came into play and the oysters were gone. And there's a very arresting image from, because it didn't just talk about Florida, it talked about oysters in general, that in New York, there's an archival photo of a place where the oyster shells are piled up. It looks like three stories high in the late 1800s. And that was around the time they were also dumping sewage in the harbor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, eventually one beat the other one. Florida, our estuaries are so productive and so important, not just to our seafood industry, but our tourism industry. We need to do what we can to save them, and they're all in trouble. And so,
And when you talk about one oyster in one day being able to filter 50 gallons of water, thinking about now green infrastructure and these natural, so that's not like a quaint little old patchy on the head. In addition to dams and dry dikes and dredges and pumping state, the solutions are better. And when you talk about the difference in cost between dumping some shells into the water that people have eaten out of restaurants in Sarasota versus building seawalls and pumping stations and building more sewage systems, the cost is a fraction and the efficacy is better.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Plus, they taste better.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.